Hi, this is Paul. I wasn't going to do any more work on the Jordan Peterson, Daniel Dennett thing, but then today I had a conversation with Wokal Distance, and he had contacted me a couple of weeks ago, wanted to talk again. We had spoken first in January of 2022. I've spoken with him with Benjamin Boyce and some other occasions and Jonathan Peugeot. But this time he had a few specific things, and some of them really touched on this Jordan Peterson, Daniel Dennett thing. So I'm going to include some of the clips in this video, because some of the things that Wokal said to me following John Searle and a bunch of philosophers that I knew nothing about, because I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a philosophy nut, I don't read a lot of philosophy. But a bunch of the things really, really addressed this conversation. So I wanted to include that. If you're really anxious to see my conversation with Wokal Distance, it's in No Wait, No Ads. It'll probably come out next week. So then after that, I did a little bit more chopping of this conversation with Peterson and Dennett. And so I'll run through it. Now, part of what happens in this space is that Dennett describes, maybe I'll play the first part of the Wokal Distance stuff, and then we'll run through the Peterson Dennett stuff, and then we'll go back over and show how it works. Okay, let's start here.
And so what he's seeing is, so Searle talks about the background, the network, and the network of intentionality is all the ideas, all of your intentional conscious content, right? Everything that's about something. Dreams, visions, ideas, thoughts, goals, all the artifacts of consciousness, the things that furnish your conscious world and your ideas. That's right. Intentionality just means ofness or aboutness. So anytime you have a thought of something or about something.
Now, if you go, I'm not going to replay it, but in the early part of the Peterson-Dennett conversation, they had the conversation about aboutness. I had never heard that term. Peterson had never heard that term. Dennett just threw it out there. Dennett explained it pretty much exactly what Wokal Distance is talking about, all getting it from John Searle.
That's intentionality. Yep. And he's saying you have a network of intentionality, all of these intentional bits of intentionality of knowing things and feeling things and having thoughts about things and imagination, and all of that forms a network of intentionality. And that gets meaning up against a background. And the background is a set of capacities, things like knowing a language, having a prefrontal cortex, being able to see, having senses, the capacity to use language, the ability to think. And the background, and he says this in his book on perception, he says, there's no hard and fast line between the background and the network, just like there's no hard and fast line between a tree and its roots. They kind of bleed into each other.
Right.
And what's happened is that the larger background, when you have a shared background, your network of intentionality, you can use the network of intentionality to get clarity, to have meaning, and to communicate. Yep. But when the background isn't shared, because meaning occurs in a network against the background, when the background isn't shared, then it's hard to create shared meaning.
Yes.
Communication becomes difficult.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's a great way to frame it.
And postmodernism is in essence the destruction of the background.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
And that makes sense. What Searle says when he talks about reading, now here's the value of artists. He says that he read the Gulag Archipelago.
Yeah.
And he said, I didn't learn a single new proposition. I knew that everything had happened. And yet I had clarity, greater clarity about what went on in the Soviet Union. And he said, well, why did that happen? He said, it didn't increase my network. It fleshed out the background.
So the point he makes right there is story. Okay, this comes through narrative. And so the narrative of the Gulag, the narrative of a work of fiction, let's say, about the Soviet Union, the narrative of all of those things, and now, of course, they have to have some connection to reality, but the narrative is really sort of gives you the background. It's the other peas. And on the Grail Country stream the other morning, Nate had a really good section on the, you know, maybe a fifth P, if they talk about it as the personal. But, and I think that's going to be where everything goes. It's very much what Peterson asserts when he says you're going to have to, your relationship style with, this is the point that I made a long time ago with respect to the spirit of finesse, your relationship style with the ineffable has to be a personal relationship style. It can't be a spirit of geometry. It has to be a spirit of finesse. It's got to be relational. It's got to be back and forth. It's got to be transjective. It's got to be, I try this, I see this, I try this, I see this, I try this, because I can't map it completely. Now, this language of the network in the background, aboutness, as Dennett says, is really critical in this. Now, what's interesting is that when Peterson and Dennett talk about this, there's some value, and this isn't unusual with conversation, there's some value in sort of going in reverse order through the conversation to see the conversation more clearly and the progression of the conversation. I'm not going to do that here, but I'm going to reference to it because that's part of what I did in preparation for this video. Now, in this section of the video, they're going to talk about trust. And what so interested me when I listened to it was Dennett basically says, well, science is all of us sitting in a room and judging your contribution. And it's like, it's a communal effort. And anybody who's obviously read Thomas Kuhn's History of Scientific Revolutions would agree, because science is much more of a conversation than an algorithm.
Okay, so that's dependent on our aim. And if our aim is at the truth, then the spirit that makes that journey possible, that's how the religious, that would be the religious formulation. The spirit that makes that journey possible will make itself manifest in the space defined by our interaction.
It would seem to me that would be a good definition of science, too.
I would agree with that, but
we can leave the religion right out of it and say it is the organization of science where...
Now again, his definition of religion is within the iron box of naturalism that says, well, supernatural stuff. So just take that right off the top. You don't need that. And he's very inconsistent. And sometimes religion is the source of all evil, and sometimes it's been a good thing, sometimes it's a nurse crop, sometimes it's just, you know, the black church fighting the white church. So he's sort of all over the map on that. But this, for him, is, oh, and it's true.
Trust is assumed, but tested, where people of different opinions come together and sort things out constructively. And that's the best test.
There's the relationality. That's the spirit of finesse. It's not the spirit of geometry. It's the spirit of finesse. Science is not the spirit of geometry. Geometry might be involved. Math might be involved, some corresponding verification might be involved, but as a whole, it's a communal enterprise.
Of all of truth.
You said, for example, that they come together in trust.
Yes.
So that I would say that so that there's a precondition for the scientific inquiry to occur even at the level of dialogue.
Yes.
And the precondition is that we can trust. What are we trusting, do you think? Are we trusting? Are we
the good
in that situation? What is it that allows for trust?
It's the goodwill that we normally assume in a civilized world.
See, right there, he gives up the whole game. He simply gives up the whole. Now, Wokel will talk about positivism. He simply gives up the whole game. Because the entire view of science is that it is not human dependent. That is the whole purpose of it, to get beyond human mistakes, human culpability. That's all about verification. And here, Dennett basically says, oh, it's developed, it's dependent on trust, it's dependent on civilization, it's dependent on goodwill, it's dependent on all of these things. Now, Peterson then is going to really challenge him, because Dennett will say, well, it's verifiable because technology works. And again, that's basically the answer that everyone gives. And then Peterson sort of turns the table and says, well, but what about China? Their technology works, and they're using technology to do evil. So at that point, Dennett backs up even further and goes back to the law.
Right. Okay. So those are part of the preconditions for the scientific endeavor that we discussed earlier. Okay. Now, I believe it was in your book you described Stephen Jay Gould's two magisteria notion, right? That there were independent magisteria. And in your book, you weren't particularly convinced by that argument. That's a good way of thinking about it.
I thought it
now,
was blunt.
Let me ask you. Okay, great. Okay, so that's very blunt. Okay, so let me reframe what you just said, including that realm of conceptualization that's in contention between you and Gould.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I heard you say, you tell me if I've got it wrong, is that the scientific enterprise nests inside another enterprise.
Yeah.
That enterprise is associated with freedom and order, a kind of order.
Civilization.
And regulated by laws. Okay. And that system itself is predicated on a system.
Now, this is an amazing thing, too. This is an amazing giving up the entire enterprise, because the point that keeps getting made by the new atheist again and again was, and it's in many ways implicit in secular democracy, is that, well, the rule of law has to be checked by science. And then you can have Sam Harris that say, well, science is going to be secular. Now, when you say that, you can either mean science is going to be about this world, and then ethics is going to be secular. So when you say that, you can either say secularity is about this world, the seculum, or secularity is religion-free. See, part of the difficulty is that there's these two definitions of the word, and there's a lot of equivocation back and forth with respect to this. And if you say, well, ethics is going to be about the seculum, you can say, well, okay. And see, I'm pulling a Verveke move that he's being criticized for. I'm using seculum in order to differentiate between these two senses that are often used of the word secular. So ethics is going to be about the seculum, or ethics is going to be godless. And the kind of godlessness they want is because many old forms of law came because the deity gave law. You find that with Hammurabi. You find that with Moses. Now, Peterson could say here, well, that was a mythical interpretation of the fact that laws are not subject to us, but we must be subject to law. And so Dennett will again and again now basically say, oh yeah, it's got to be within civilization, it's got to be within law. Well, then it's no longer objective. Then it's no longer universal. Then it's really constrained. And of course, this is exactly the point that Peterson keeps pushing him into the corner with, and saying, Dennett just doesn't seem conscious. It's sort of like that. I've never seen it tried, but they say it works, where all of the students get together and decide every time the teacher takes a step towards the corner of the classroom, they will all smile and give positive reinforcement that might not be picked up consciously, but somewhere in the teacher's brain, subconsciously. So then just unconsciously, the teacher, the classroom, the students will back the teacher into a corner. That seems to be exactly what Peterson is doing here. So because I have limited time, I'm going to play this other little short one.
The foundational elements, see, this is why I introduced the definition of the religious that I started the conversation with, is that because my sense is that the proper religious enterprise is the inquiry not only into the foundational elements, let's say, that underlie the civilization within which science is nested, but that also govern the relationship between that foundation and the transformations of the foundation that are necessary. I'll give you an example.
And I think Peterson is exactly right there. And that's why he starts out the conversation with Dennett's definition of religion, because Peterson knows right off the bat, this doesn't work. It is not a proper definition of religion. It is a straw man definition of religion that in a modernist context is designed to basically move people away from participation or belief in the Bible and things like this. Now, let's see what... And so throughout this conversation, Peterson just basically keeps backing him into a corner. And Dennett basically says, well, it's all nested in civilization. It's nested in law. And in one case, it's nested in us community of scientists who are all in agreement. We all see this one way. And if someone is coming in acting differently, we say, nope, 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 you can't participate here. But now, again, here it is.
And so what he's seeing is, so Searle talks about the background, the network, and the network of intentionality is all the ideas, all of your intentional conscious content, right? Everything that's about something, dreams, visions, ideas, thoughts, goals, all the artifacts of consciousness, the things that furnish your conscious world and your ideas. That's right. Intentionality just means ofness or aboutness. So anytime you have a thought of something or about something, that's intentionality.
Yep.
And he's saying you have a network of intentionality, all of these intentional bits of intentionality of knowing things and feeling things and having thoughts about things and imagination, and all of that forms a network of intentionality. And that gets meaning up against a background. And the background is a set of capacities, things like knowing a language, having a prefrontal cortex, being able to see, having senses, the capacity to use language, the ability to think. And the background, and he says this in his book on perception, he says there's no hard and fast line between the background and the network. Just like,
and that's really key. Because the idea is, you know, that little short clip, Peterson says, not only is religion about the foundation, it's also modulating, in Wokal Distance's words, the relationship between the root and the tree. It's the connecting, and religion is doing all of these modulating, and religion is doing this live. And, you know, these are arguments, some of these are arguments that I made back when I started making this video, because... Again, if you listen to the New Atheists, what the New Atheists tend to say is that, well, religion is all about... It's amazing that they say this. Actually being in a religious group. Religion is all about mindless obedience to a set of dead regulations. And I just laugh at this. I just laugh at this. Because if you read history, church history, you'll find that the supposedly mindless obedience to dead regulations, even when certain communities which imagine themselves that they are either going to believe or practice just as it was done in the New Testament church, all of these restorationist movements and traditions, they all wind up looking different. Why? For these reasons. And when you think, again, I've mentioned the book Transubstantiation and Luther and Aquinas and Aristotle, you know, a big part of what had happened between Luther and Aristotle is that the background had shifted dramatically so that even when they're using the same words, those words no longer have their meaning because the network and the background are in kind of a living dynamic with each other. So when Luther starts basically hauling off and cussing and using all of his potty language, if you listen to the rest of his history, about Aquinas and Aristotle, and Sockold comes around, you know, centuries later and writes a book and says, you know, really? What Luther was trying to do with consubstantiation was pretty much what Aquinas, if properly understood, sort of understood it, transubstantiation. And this continues because these things are moving and the meaning happens between the network and the background.
there's no hard and fast line between a tree and its roots. They kind of bleed into each other.
Right.
And what's happened is that the larger background, when you have a shared background, your network of intentionality, you can use the network of intentionality to get clarity, to have meaning, and to communicate. Yep. But when the background isn't shared, because meaning occurs in a network against a background, when the background isn't shared, then it's hard to create shared meaning.
Yes.
Communication becomes difficult.
And so what Dennett is talking about with this group of scientists in the university that all think alike, so say we all, and someone comes in and they're not acting in the right way, they say, no, I'm sorry, you're not right. And of course, the postmodernists come along and basically dig all this out from under them. I think that's exactly right. I think that's a great way to frame it.
And postmodernism is in essence the destruction of the background.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
And that makes sense. What Searle says when he talks about reading, now here's the value of artists. He says that he read the Gulag Archipelago. He said, I didn't learn a single new proposition. I knew that everything had happened. And yet I had clarity, greater clarity about what went on in the Soviet Union. And he said, well, why did that happen? He said, it didn't increase my network. It flushed out the background.
And that is really key. Now, I went on, I made a little clip and I posted it on Twitter. But I went on into that conversation and talked about the massiveness of the background.
Snapshots of philosophy as they are, and we're maybe holding on to a few arguments from Plantinga and Swinburne. Meanwhile, that background that existed, like the history of...
He's basically making the argument that Christian philosophy has been so impoverished lately because Christian philosophers aren't reading broadly enough. They're sort of depending on Plantinga and Swinburne, but they're not reading broadly enough to understand basically a bunch of the guys that he quoted and read and that we talked to in this conversation.
Philosophy, somebody asks, why do we continue to teach the history of philosophy? We don't need to know like the history of every theory of physics. Why? Because it's that history of philosophy which maintains your background against which everything has meaning. And when you forget the background...
And so... I don't know that that's always true of history, and it's certainly not true of technology, because what people have seen is that after two generations, knowledge of technology begins to pass away because other technologies have subsumed it. But if those technologies are more complex, and if that knowledge is lost, then these technologies can get into real trouble, and civilization that's dependent on these technologies can get into real trouble.
Your network starts to lose its cohesiveness because the network is only interpreted against a background.
Which is, interestingly enough, sort of also Verveke's relevance realization point, that in fact, they're always, because the relevance realization is essentially a network and background issue. You have to know, be able to distinguish them. You have to be able to differentiate them. And so part of what goes on with relevance realization is embedded in a community, embedded in a narrative, having a common background, but with all of the ambiguities of the roots and the trees, relevance realization is sort of sussing these things out. And that's, again, why Verveke always says that your biases, you know, cut both ways. Your relevance realization and your biases, they're the same thing. You're just always working these problems transjectively. You're working them in terms of the spirit of finesse, and you're working them in community, and you've got different people trying different ones, and everybody's sort of watching the outcomes, and everybody's making judgments. But of course, all of their judgments are made both with the past and, well, he's... Wokel has a great quote from C.S. Lewis that basically says, you know, we have to use the past because we don't know the future. That's a terrific quote. I'll have to find it. But that's what we're doing with this relevance realization. But there's a hitch, and the hitch has to do with combinatorial explosion and our size. And for all that John has talked about, maybe he'll come back. I don't know that he's actually... I don't
I think he's identified a number of, I think he's been able to go down a level of resolution to say, now these are some of the things at play that sort of help us to distinguish them. But I think, I think we're just too deep that will. I think we're deeper than, I think we are, we ourselves are deeper than the network or the consciousness. I loved it when, and that's why human beings are, they're in the image of God. They're in some ways inexhaustible. He has placed eternity in our hearts. There's an inexhaustibleness to us. And by virtue of the massive, the network is massive. He used an example of, you know, there's not a 7,500 foot statue in New York City of Godzilla. Okay. Why do I know there's not a 7,500 foot statue of Godzilla in New York City? Well, you might say, well, I've been to New York City many times. If in fact there were such a statue, I probably would have heard about it because it would have been in national news. In terms of the way we imagine science works, that, well, I haven't been to New York City in a while. It's correspondence. I can go to New York City and check, because hiding a 7,500 foot statue of Godzilla in New York City would be extremely difficult. But the point that he made with that is background knowledge. It's all the background knowledge that lets me say there's not a 7,500 foot statue of Godzilla in New York City. Now, might there be one? I suppose it's possible. But this function of communal background knowledge is very much what's at play with our plausibility structures. So I'm continuing to make my way through Carlos Erie's wonderful book, They Flew. So I, growing up Protestant, are by no means knowledgeable of Roman Catholic or Orthodox hagiography. One of the interesting things that I see happening now with this re-enchantment, let's call it, is that people are reading hagiographies and they're slurping them up with a spoon. They're really enjoying them. Now, Carlos Erie is a professional historian, so he adopts sort of a modernist posture with respect to these things, but tries to stay open. But Dennett's whole definition of religion is basically a, and C.S. Lewis pointed this out a long time ago, is basically an assumed prejudice. It's his background. Why don't supernatural things happen? Because of naturalism. Well, there it is. That's the whole thing. Again, Lewis begins his book, Miracles, saying, the only person I know that claims to have seen a ghost doesn't believe in ghosts. That's the perfect way to begin that book, because that's exactly how we are. Once your background says women don't fly, then Teresa of Avila never flew. Men don't levitate. Then Joseph of Cupertino, despite all of the firsthand accounts of these people levitating and flying, it didn't happen. Well, why? My background. So say we all. But of course, if you're there, you can see it. And then if someone asks you, well, what about that levitation? Yeah, he levitated. But levitation doesn't happen. That's right. But he levitated. Yes, but it doesn't happen. That's right. And you can live most of your life with that contradiction. I see people do it all the time. Because that background is a communal mapping that we all share. And you don't want to lose it, or you're going to be on the wrong side of Daniel Dennett's faculty meeting. Gilchrist said, our unconscious selves are like 97.5% of us, and Our consciousness is just like this tiny little thing. And that seemed right. And what that means is that the network will always be grossly limited against the background.
Yeah. And it's also why, as Quine said, because we're going to quote Quine some more, decisions in science as in life can be difficult, and there's no simple touchstone for responsible belief. There is no procedure of mechanical verification in which we can guarantee a proper and appropriate epistemology.
That is exactly what Peterson has been. Well, Peterson hasn't gone that far yet, but Quine has. And I didn't know anything about this philosopher. We talked about him a little bit. Wokel had some great quotes from him. But what he said right there, listen to that.
Decisions in science as in life can be difficult. Because we're going to quote Quine some more. Decisions in science as in life can be difficult, and there's no simple touchstone for responsible belief.
Decisions in science and life can be difficult, and there's no simple touchstone. In other words, the verification of science. Now, technology works well enough, and in every piece of technology, there's always things like, tolerances built into things. Why? Because it's not going to be perfect. And if you're doing, I remember when I took my first engineering course at college, we were doing drafting. And so you always have tolerances. This has to be plus or minus within this. Because it's never going to be perfect. You have to know that. Now, science in the abstract is perfect. Science in the real world never is. And when it comes down to small things, well, simple things, you can get pretty good. But once combinatorial explosiveness takes over, you know, we're basically working on rough maps collectively, and that's the best we can do. This is part of the reason, if you go back a few months when Peterson was talking, or a year ago or so, when Peterson was talking about sanity, the decision between sanity and insanity is collective. It has to be for these reasons.
There is no procedure of mechanical verification in which we can guarantee a proper and appropriate epistemology.
There's no procedure for mechanical verification. This is the point of Verveke's relevance realization. Because you can't boil this down to an algorithm. Now, that's sort of the black boxness of Verveke's relevance realization. That when he first listened to him, I think, boy, sure sounds like a black box. And now, even though I can't penetrate that black box, I can understand why it's got a black box nest to it. Because you can't break it down via an algorithm because of combinatorial explosiveness. There's just, the world is too big and we are too small and time limits us, so we will only get so far. And so we're dependent on this massive background, but what's been happening is that this background has been changing.
Epistemology.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You can do it in science, in a very limited realm of science, but in ethics and in metaphysics.
Yeah.
P.G. Campbell said that the only test of a true metaphysics is that it's a thing you can't describe your way out of.
The only test of a true metaphysics is it's a thing you can't describe your way out of. Watch. So Nate reacted when I posted this in No Aid, No Ads. And other people have been reacting because the whole woke, anti-woke thing is kind of a sub-background rift in our more collective background. And of course, there are many rifts like it. And so if you're more woke than anti-woke, of course, you know, by reputation, you're going to be doing this with wokal distance. Fine. Watch the video. Don't watch the video. It's fine. I very much enjoyed my conversation with him. The limited degree to which we are friends, we don't talk very often, but every time we talk, we are brothers in Christ, as we talked about it earlier in the video. I always have a good time talking to him. And again, I mean, part of what this little corner is about is talking to people with whom we have differences. So that's, but what he said right there is so much what a lot of the stuff that Luke and Grail Country are, it's a lot of the tree they're really barking up.
Can guarantee a proper and appropriate epistemology. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
For,
yeah.
You can do it in yeah. science, in a very limited yeah. realm of science, but in ethics and in yeah. metaphysics.
Yeah.
They're the only, well, I mean.
Now, this guy was his teacher, but notice he's got it memorized.
P.G. Campbell said that the only test of a true metaphysics is that it's a thing you can't describe your.
The only test of a true metaphysics, it's a thing you can't describe your way out of. That's almost every live stream that Luke does. It's almost every live stream that Luke does.
Way out of?
But, that's a good quote, too.
I know. That was my teacher.
That was his teacher. We talk about autodidacts and the whole conversation. I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the conversation. I always love talking to him. So I can call him Michael because his name is on his Twitter handle. But we always have a good conversation together. We almost always wind up talking longer off camera than on camera. And it's just sort of, like I said, we don't talk very often, but every time we talk, I really enjoy and have a sense of closeness with him. And then to the last clip, and then I'll land the plane here.
There was an aesthetic appeal to adopting a background of the secular humanist thought, which is if we can simplify it down, we can get everything we want. We can get these simple things, and then we can build on it, and right. things get a little bit right. more complex. And they wanted to make things simple. They wanted a simple world and a simple universe, and they didn't realize that all of the tools of science that they were using come out of that the meaning of those things.
Well, I'd say even more than just that they wanted a simple and an aesthetic, it was because later, was that on camera or off camera? I don't remember. We talked basically about the hierarchies of, I don't know who's yelling outside. I should stick my head out and find out what's going on the street. We're always looking up and trying to climb up a ladder. And so then when we have sort of taken on technology sort of woos us in a certain direction. And then we, well, if it's working in technology, just like Daniel Dennett was saying, if it's working in technology, well then certainly if we can improve performance in the church, the way we are improving performance in transportation, in optics, in studying of the stars, now health came quite a bit later. It's very much lagging because health is so complex. But if we can prove performance in all of these other ways via technology, surely through this certainty, we ought to be able to improve performance in terms of our religious operations. John Van Donk sent me a really good thing from Experimental Theology and about Bonhoeffer that I'm certainly going to have to integrate into this because it's all about the religionless, a religionless Christianity. And that's, you know, Daniel Dennett now, he said, Christianity, nah, but religionless, yes, that's what he's all up for because religion is like spooky stuff, wooey stuff, supernatural stuff. And well, it's all down here is science. But of course, Peterson's backing him into a corner. And Wokal Distance basically says, this is why he's backing him into a corner. This is why that whole framing of the world is going away. It's no longer working. And the same is true for churches and church people.
Occurs against a very particular kind of a background. The reason that science has emerged in Western civilization before it emerged other places is not because of the network of propositions that they had. It's because of the
background. And again, where I was going with this is the crisis in the church right now is, why would I go there? And I think the answer is because you have to get the background. And if you don't get... So when you look at, again, people... go back to 2018, I start making Randall's conversations. Conversation after conversation after conversation, I see that people's lives are improving by watching dozens, if not hundreds of hours of Jordan Peterson, the biblical series, his class lectures, all of this stuff. People were depressed. Now, especially young men, now they have more agency. They're doing better. There's thousands upon thousands of examples like this. Many of you listening to it can attest to it. And that's Daniel Dennett's technological proof. But you say, why? Why would watching all of this Jordan Peterson help someone's life?
And I think even in some ways Jordan Peterson struggles to know why he said that multiple times. And 12 rules for life. Well, following these simple rules. No, that's not really the rules. It's not really the rules. What we've been messing around with all of these screens and what Jordan Peterson sort of realigned and why when people start going to church and going to mass and going to the liturgy, why they start getting reoriented is because it's fixing their background. And we're all thinking, well, it has to be sort of direct, pedagogical, propositional education at the background. And because I think you're right, because and then part of what happened in a lot of churches was, well, we're going to give you the bucket of propositions. And yep. we're going to run you through the bucket of propositions. And when you recognize that you can regurgitate to us the bucket of propositions, then you will have what you need to go out into the world. But it's exactly the same vision that you just stated with the positivist. It's exactly the same vision, mm-hmm. which is very much what happened. Let's see if I have. I do. Okay. Which is very much what has continued to happen. And you know, Protestants, of course, have been some Protestants. They're insanely diverse. But some Protestants have basically made this the heart of it. Well, let's boil it down. Let's get these discipleship programs down. And I would argue that, well, there's some things that people are picking up from these discipleship programs and from these very propositional things. Propositional are 1/4 of Verveke's piece, and perhaps 1/5 if we get into the personal. But it's probably not all the propositional. As a pastor, I completely believe this. It's all the relationships with other Christians. It's being enfolded into a different network. And what you really begin to derive when you start going to church is you are now embedded in an entirely different network. You're embedded in an entirely different story. And that's why the transformation happens, because your background improves, and now you have more agency, and you can better address life. And that is why modernity is receding. The church isn't going anywhere. The church is going to struggle. That's by no means the answer to all these questions. But that's what's happening. Now, I'm really happy with this video. And that little video that I put out today, which gets all the views, because it's the first video I put out with Daniel Dennett and a whole bunch of newbies signed, you know, clicked onto this and we're out of it within a minute, because I don't want to listen to this ranting guy with the white beard and the blue shirt and whatever he's sipping in that thing. I don't want to listen to something like that. So, but hopefully enough of you will listen to it, because I thought actually this was pretty darn important. So I thought it was important. Let me know what you think in the comment section.